Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null. Got my mojo
working, but just don't work on you. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how garlic can help you if you've had high blood pressure. We're also going to talk about the role of nuts and seeds protecting against all causes of death. And can mistletoe treat cancer? And a lot more, all from peer-reviewed mainstream literature. Then we're going to take a look in our environmental segment about California's drought could upend America's entire food system. From Climate Progress, from Natasha Gelling, I'll share some ideas that I believe those of you who are looking for the next step in the evolution of our country, you'll get ahead of this curve, and you'll benefit from it, and others will as well. Also tomorrow, or probably in the next day or two, Congress is going to give a thumbs up in all likelihood to Obama's Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. Why it's a bad idea, I'll give you 2 points of view, including how Obama's group secretly lobbied corporate leaders to say positive things about the Trans-Pacific deal, and also why the founding fathers would oppose fast track. Oh, and speaking about founding fathers, well, according to America's most Christian, America was founded based upon Christian principles, and we hear it all the time. We hear it from people running for president. Is it true? Well, we'll have a little discussion on that. And for those who are looking to be a little more spiritual, well, we'll take a look at that. And then for those who think that the war on crime is a good thing, especially the people over at Fox, we'll share the insights from a retired police detective who worked in the war on crime of why it's been a massive boondoggle. It doesn't work, hasn't worked, never has worked. But it sure does work to make profits for the private prison system. And it also gives some self-righteous people an opportunity to say, see, we're getting the criminals off the street. Yeah, if you and your buddies in the Republican Democratic Party would go to jail, we'd get a lot of criminals off the street and take everyone on Wall Street. Wall Street should be one big empty cavern with no one working there. Then it would be a better country. Let's begin. We have a lot to share today. Garlic. Garlic is unique in that it is one of the top 10 foods that we should have in our diet on a regular basis. It is very powerful once you consume it because it can kill bacteria, viruses, it can stimulate a thinning of the blood. On all levels, garlic is good. Now, if you know you're not going to go out, you're not on a date, you don't have to worry about being up close to people, then load up on it. And also, the best time to take garlic is before you go to bed at night because it thins the blood overnight, kills bacteria and strep and viruses overnight. This is from the China Academy of Science Medical Sciences, published in the peer-reviewed journal Phytomedicine. Quote, dietary supplements with garlic may beneficially affect blood pressure for hypertensives. This is a multiple study. It's 7 randomized controlled trials. Quote, the present meta-analysis suggests that garlic is an effective and safe approach for the management of hypertension, which may be an alternative therapy in patients with a history of the condition. So that's important. Yesterday, at the very end of the program, I played a little clip of testimonials of people who had just finished a week of a health retreat. And unlike other very good and very important health retreats that people go to around the world, I think most of them are going to be very beneficial, de-stressing, relaxing, doing yoga, having healthier foods and juices. But when I do one, I like to emphasize upon functional foods, meaning the food has a function in your body, hopefully something that will give you probiotics, detoxify you, thin your blood, help your heart, rejuvenate tissue. And one of the people who made a comment was a chef. And he had been on multiple high blood pressure medications to bring it down. But even with those multiple blood pressure medications, he was only able to budget down a little bit. Within 2 days of being on a really functional food program, protocol, he was able to bring his blood pressure down to completely normal with no medications, and it sustained itself. Also, I just spoke with Utrice Lead, and Utrice will be on this program next week as a guest to talk about her state of health. On Tuesday of next week, she goes to the hospital that did the original diagnosing of the stage 4B lung cancer and ovarian metastasis cancer and other parts in her body. And when they opened her up, they closed her up. They said there's nothing they can do. She should, quote, seek a quality of life. That's code word for hospice care. And but as of today, instead of being able to just wobble without balance and go maybe 3 feet, 4 feet, and then have to stop out of breath using a walker or a cane, Utrice walks 24 laps on a track per day. That's 6 miles at a good pace. She's down around the 4 minute mile pace. No cane, has her balance, lost weight, and her diabetes, and she was on multiple medications. Her fasting blood sugar is normal, and her blood pressure is down to normal. In fact, she's on no medicine. And now the state of her cancer, we don't know. That's why before having her on, I want a full, complete, orthodox medical checkup from the very people who did the original checkup and surgery so that she can come on and tell us the status. And keep in mind, she's past her death date, so every day is an inspiring day for her, and she takes nothing for granted. And one of the reasons that she is alive today, there are many reasons, but one of the most important is that every single thing that goes into her body must serve a purpose of healing. Functional foods, functional juices, and that's what she's doing. So every glass of that juice, every single choice of a fruit or vegetable, tuber or grain, is important because it helps the body. And one of the things she's taking massive amounts of is garlic. And onion as well. Now, normally a person wouldn't have an onion juice. It's just too strong. So you dilute it. But if you add garlic and onion together in a diluted juice, let's say you dilute it with celery or cucumber, it protects your heart. It kills bacteria. It kills cancer cells. Yeah. So that study I just reported is just one of many. Here's another. Quote, a meta-analysis of a large body of science supporting cardiovascular benefits of garlic. This was published in the Journal of Science of Food and Agriculture, concluded that garlic may also reduce cholesterol and triglycerides levels. Researchers at Sendong University reported that compared to placebos, garlic consumption is associated with reduction in cholesterol and triglycerides. So that's all good. Now, nuts and seeds are good too, but a lot of people don't eat the nuts and seeds because they think, well, it's going to be fattening. Not true. A major university in the Netherlands has just done a study on this. And what they have found is, and this was published in the International Journal of Epidemiology, confirms the link between peanut and nut intake and lower death rates. And that's important. Men and women who eat at least 10 grams of nuts per day or peanuts per day have a lower risk of dying from several major causes of death than people who don't consume nuts or peanuts. Now, 10 grams is a small amount. To give you an idea, 28.35 grams equal an ounce. So we're dealing with about one-third of an ounce. So just a tiny amount, like we're talking about a tablespoon of nuts or seeds will do this for you, allow you to live a longer life. And the reduction in death was strongest for respiratory disease, neurodegenerative disease, diabetes, followed by cancer and cardiovascular disease. And the effects are equal in men and women, and peanuts show at least a strong reduction in mortality as tree nuts. And that's important. Now, again, I'm suggesting organic nuts, and because sometimes when people think they're allergic to peanuts, they're not allergic to peanuts. They're allergic to how it was processed. Was it cooked in cottonseed oil or canola oil, and was it organic? That all makes a difference, in this Netherlands cohort study ran for a long period of time. Over 120,000 individuals participated in it. So here's the takeaway message. If you want to live a longer life by doing something that's relatively easy and inexpensive, have a tablespoon of nuts or seeds, sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, chia seeds, sesame seeds in your diet each day, or nuts, walnuts, pistachios, almonds, cashews, macadamias, filberts, Brazil nuts, hazelnuts, pine nuts. They're all healing and they're all good. And also, vitamin D, according to the Great Ormond Street Hospital for Children, published in the Journal of American Society of Nephrology, showed that if you have a child that has kidney disease, vitamin D supplements can make an enormous difference in helping your child. In fact, five-year kidney survival was 75% in patients with vitamin D and 50% with those without it. That's a big difference. So get the vitamin D into your kids. And finally, can mistletoe treat cancer? Well, mistletoe has long been the subject of legend. When found on oak trees, it was considered by the Celtic people as sacred and was ritualistically harvested by the Druids. Well, more recent tradition dictates that man and woman who meet under the mistletoe must kiss, a tradition that has been relegated to Christmas. But what about its health impact? Over a decade ago, research started to come in showing that it has important benefits. And it's because of the iscador, I-S-C-A-D-O-R, and in the active ingredients, mistletoe, and it was shown to treat successfully ovarian, lung, and breast cancer. And medical journals document research involving the use of mistletoe as an anti-cancer agent, and I found some that go back to 1952, but it really started to get on an upswing in the research more recently. But there was a German study published in 1979 when given to women with advanced stage ovarian cancer, resulted in an average of survival of 16.2 months in comparison to 5 months survival in patients treated with anything else. Wow, well, you're giving a tremendous increase in people's survival. In other studies, iscador improved survival times of patients with lung cancer and breast cancer. And in a study involving cancer patients treated with iscador, and those who reported no use, a mean survival time was 40% longer in the iscador use. And why? How does it work? Well, what we know now is there's the mechanism that increases the natural killer cell activity. By the way, vitamin C does the same thing. An intravenous really increases killer cell activity. And also, it increases DNA repair in treated breast cancer patients. So you're getting a better quality of life, a longer life, and likelihood that you're going to be using other alternative therapies also that could allow you to live even longer. I'm Gary Noll. That's our health and nutrition update. Now let's take a look at the environment. It is not just California, and we're making a mistake of looking just at California as severe drought. We also have severe drought in Georgia. And don't be fooled by the fact that you can get some torrential rain. In fact, Texas has had some of the most extreme rain in the United States. And people say, oh, well, you know, no problem now. All of our reservoirs are full and our lakes are full. Yeah, it's correct. But the reality is that those reservoirs, in the absence of continuous rain, will deplete themselves within a year. So, you know, it's like selling something immediately, selling a kidney today, and then thinking, I'm good, I got my money, I can pay my rent. No, you know, you only got one more kidney and the money's going to run out. We're running out of time. The water is not there where we need it in a consistent way, and when it is, it's torrential, and a lot of that is runoff water. So it does not go down to the deeper aquifers. There's multiple aquifers, and sometimes you have to go down 700, 1,200, 2,000 feet to get to the deeper aquifers. And most individuals cannot afford that, not at $100 a foot. So They look at the local and the shallow aquifers. But those will go quickly. I'll give you an example. Last Sunday, I was running around Central Park with our running and walking club. By the way, where we'll be meeting tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, 5th Avenue and 90th Street. It's free. And we help people get into condition, showing them how to power walk and run. And a lot of people are there. It's a wonderful experience. And we're the only holistic running and walking club in the tri-state area. And so anyhow, there was a couple from some foreign country, and they were commenting upon, oh, there's a lake. And I said, no, it's not a lake. It's the reservoir. And I just mentioned to them that that's an emergency reservoir. Oh, it's big. I say big. There's 3 hours worth of water in there if all the water in Manhattan were cut off. 3 hours. That much water? That much water. So we have to understand it can be deceptive when we see rain filling areas that were depleted because the drought comes, the heat comes, and you don't have any more rain, it goes. So we have places such as Colorado, Kansas, South Dakota, Wyoming. We have all of California, New Mexico, Utah, Nevada, and South Dakota. I mentioned that, New Mexico and Arizona. All of those are running out of water in Oklahoma. So you're dealing with a lot of states representing over 60 million Americans. So you got a lot of people who are going to have a challenged future. Now, it's not as if all water will be gone. There will always be water. It can be brought in and for the deeper aquifers and even desalinization. But how much of the water that will exist can help the people? Well, first, they're not going to give it to the people because the people don't count in America. Industry counts. The dairy industry, the meat industry, and the food industry. Big Agra controls the water, and it's not being rationed. So they can use an enormous amount on things such as alfalfa or cotton that we shouldn't be growing anyhow in the United States. And if we had to grow cotton based upon not subsidizing it, you wouldn't have one single cotton plant growing in America. But the government subsidizes. Most people are not aware of that. And so we're going to have major, major, major food problems in the United States, starting with California. It's just starting now. It's only going to get worse. But there's a silver lining to this, and I'll tell you that in a moment. Jerry Brown, the governor of California, recently was in the Sierra Nevada Mountains, and he was standing where it normally is covered in 5 feet of snow. The trouble is the Sierra snowpack, the frozen well that feeds California's reservoirs and supplies a third of its water, was just 8% of its annual yield, meaning it was 92% down. That's a historic low for a state that has become accustomed to breaking down drought records. Now, in the middle of the snowless field, Brown took an unprecedented step mandating that urban agencies curtail their water use by 25%, a move that would save about 500 billion gallons of water by next year. And that seems like a huge amount until you consider that California's almond industry, for example, uses twice as much water as the entire water population of California every year. And yet Brown's mandatory cuts did not touch the state's agricultural business. And agriculture requires water, and large-scale agriculture like that in California requires large amounts of water. So when Governor Brown came under fire for exempting farmers from the mandatory cuts, farmers use 80% of the state's available water, he didn't care. According to Natasha Gelling, quote, "They're not watering their lawn or taking long showers this week. They're providing most of the fruits and vegetables of America to a significant part of the world." So his idea was, you know, forget about everything except we're feeding the world. Okay, well, almonds get a lot of attention when it comes to California's agriculture and water, but the state is responsible for an enormous diversity of produce. If you eat a salad, odds are, unless you shop at a local farmer's market, The lettuce, carrots, and celery came from California. If you like stone fruit, California produces 84% of the country's fresh peaches, 94% of the plums. 99% of artichokes are grown in California and all of America, and 94% of the broccoli. And also, when the spring comes, we produce 50% of asparagus. That'll come from California. So that is tremendous amount. And so it's not just a California problem. But here's the deal. A long time ago, the developers and Big Agra decided, let's make California the central place where we grow all this. And the California Central Valley, and I've flown over it many times, that's where they grow it. Well, that stretches 450 miles between the Sierra Nevadas and the California Coast Range. And it's probably the single most productive tract of land in the world. From its soil springs, 230 varieties of crops, so diverse that their places of botanical origin range from Southeast Asia to Mexico. It produces two-thirds of the nation's produce and 80% of the world's almonds. And if you've had tomatoes, even a tomato sauce out of a can, 94% are grown and picked in Central Valley. And clear up through Napa Valley, which, by the way, has a history of earthquakes. It's resulted in 14 different microclimate quakes that have affected everything up there. In any case, here's the solution. They're taking 500,000 acres out this year because of drought. That's not much. It may seem like a lot, but it's not when you consider how many millions of acres they're growing. There are a lot of places in America where we have great soil, plenty of water, and we're talking about abundant water that it would not impact the state's use at all. Wisconsin and New York, Massachusetts and Maine and Rhode Island and Vermont, Pennsylvania and Virginia, so and much of Ohio. So we have plenty of places in the United States to grow all the food that's now growing in California. And we even have some areas where the future is going to be hydroponics, so it really doesn't matter what time of year it is or whether there's drought or not, you're going to be able to grow. If you hit a 110-degree day, it's not going to kill the plants. The plants are going to be protected because at 85 degrees, the fans turn on automatically and wick out the hot air at the top of the greenhouses and keep it at 85 degrees so nothing dies. And also nothing's going to rot because of the excess water. Remember, when you have too much water, and this is for anything, you're going to rot the roots, especially if you're not on a hill. And I've said many times that all orchards should be on the side of hills. And you should, when you plant your fruit tree, you should always make a little six-foot gully and run a little pipe from the fruit tree base down so that water cannot pool. But if you're in a floodplain or if you're in a flat area, even if it's not a floodplain, or if you have clay underneath your plant, there's no place for the water to go. So it rots the roots and that kills the plant or it stunts the fruit as it's growing. So I see this as a good thing in this respect only. I see it's good if we are forced then to diversify, get away from a central place to grow everything, and start bringing multi-agriculture, hopefully organic and biodynamic, to other areas of America. And also that would help with the environment, because when you're driving a truck filled with produce from California to Maine, instead of growing it in Maine, you're creating a carbon footprint. And that simply is not healthy for the environment. Also, by growing locally, you can have the advantage of bringing a greater variety of crops at different times of year to your local markets. So that's my thoughts on it. Now to the issue of fast-tracking. This we just found out. We didn't know this, but we have to thank WikiLeaks for giving this to us. Quote, this is from Reader Support News, Paul Ken Klenenstein. Quote, the White House invited senior members of the Sony Corporation to make statements in favor of the controversial Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, according to an internal Sony email published by WikiLeaks. The email sent by Sony Executive Vice President Keith Weaver to its CEO and other executives mentions, quote, meeting with Froman, Obama's trade representative, Michael Froman, and your peers at the White House last year. The email then alludes to President Obama's apparent efforts to lobby the business sector to make statements to support the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Quote, the President and Froman want key industries saying positive things about the Trans-Pacific Partnership benefits. Okay. Well, they got a big hustle going out there. I believe that the only way we can stop the Trans-Pacific Partnership is if the unions agree to a general strike and make a public statement, all of them, that they will not support Democratic candidates for any office. That's the only way that there's going to be enough muscle to have all the other Democrats back off and all the people of the United States who care about this to let their legislator know, if you vote for this, we actively campaign against you. That's the only language politicians understand. Unfortunately, where many union leaders and their members do support a challenge to this, there's always going to be that don't go too far, say just enough to keep your base happy, but not enough to derail this. Because later on, you want to get that support of whoever's in the White House, especially if they're capable of helping your cause or your group. And that's the danger. This has to be an all-in, where you say, that's it. We're going to go against this, you, and cause a general strike. If we had a general strike, which we need, we desperately need a general strike in the United States, if nothing else to bring attention to the power of the minorities. If every black and Latino said, too bad, for the next week we're not going to work. We're not going to the hospitals. See how that works for you. We're not going to do anything that we would normally do in any profession to bring attention to how much racism, inequality, and bad politics are going on. And until this is corrected, till we have people who represent us, we the people, we're going to stay out. It would bring America right to a standstill. You couldn't fly any airplanes. You would have trains would stop. But as long as people don't commit themselves, then down the road, when fascism is the norm, when we become a full-fledged police state, then don't complain. Gee whiz, why don't I have any freedom? Well, you had a moment to stand up against tyranny, and you chose not to. This is from Ben Beachy from Counterpunch. Why the Founding Fathers Would Oppose Fast Track. Tomorrow, members of Congress plan to take a controversial career-defining vote, that's today, by the way, on fast-tracking, the largest expansion to date of the unpopular status quo trade model. A majority of the U.S. public, most House Democrats, and a sizable block of House Republicans stand in opposition. The coalition opposing fast-track for the Trans-Pacific Partnership is larger and more diverse than any preceding trade policy fight, including internet freedom advocates, family farmers, environmentalists, Main Street businesses, labor unions, feminists, faith groups, and consumer advocates, development organizations, the LGBT groups, and retirees. The breadth of the opposition reflects the wide scope of broadly held goals that the sweeping Trans-Pacific Partnership PAC would undermine: middle-class jobs, Wall Street reform, food safety, internet freedom, a clean environment, and affordable health care, to name a few. But if that weren't enough for members of Congress still on the fence, a new legal analysis reveals that the Trans-Pacific Partnership may also undermine the U.S. Constitution. That's the conclusion of Alan Morrison, a constitutional law professor and associate dean at George Washington University Law School, who has practiced law for 45 years, taught at six law schools, including Harvard, and argued 20 Supreme Court cases. Morrison warns in a letter to Congress that the Trans-Pacific Partnership's proposed expansion of a controversial parallel legal system for foreign corporations, quote, known as investor-state dispute settlements, improperly removes a core judicial function from the federal courts and therefore violates Article 3 of the Constitution. The Trans-Pacific Partnership expansion of ISDS would newly empower thousands of foreign corporations to bypass the entire U.S. legal system and challenge U.S. laws before private international tribunals comprised of three attorneys. These three individuals would not be constitutionally appointed and salaried by U.S. judges, but private lawyers who are paid by the hour. As Morrison points out, quote, many of those who serve as arbitrators in these courts cases represent others. So that's what he's saying. He's saying it's a violation of our Constitution. And so now, today is the day. Make your phone calls, make your emails, and let your legislator know you're going to follow this. And if he or she votes for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you'll actively vote against them. And I'd like to see the unions go out on strike, general strike. I'd like to see something that hasn't happened for a long time in America. The courage to make decisions based upon the ethics of what is right for the American public instead of what is politically expedient. We're going to take a break and be right back. Please stay with us. More to come. Nice to be back in New York. First day back in the new studios. And not done yet. Another 2 weeks and they'll be 100% done. State-of-the-art studios. And just feels good to be back. And next Wednesday, I'm looking forward to meeting many of you at the premiere of the new feature film documentary, Saving the Planet. And in a way that we can all participate in helping to make a difference. I know a lot of people think the issue is too big, it's too complex. You know, who am I to make a difference? Once you see this film, you realize you do make a difference. And what to do on an issue is compelling and necessary to address as our tipping points in the environment. And you're gonna find this a moving film. We were filled up yesterday, so I'm asking, and we are filled up, I'm asking people who called in initially to make the reservation, if you know you're not coming, please call today and cancel, because we have a lot of people who'd like to attend. It's a fundraiser for our station in New York, WBAI, and we'd like to have everyone who wants to attend. Our number is 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422, and it's $30, and you're going to get two copies of the film also to take home with you. And there's a panel afterwards. So, and then I'm going to be up in Woodstock at a theater there presenting it. And I'll give you more on that next week. But for now, we are full. And I'm sorry that for those of you who are not able to attend, but too often people wait and wait and wait. And then they think, oh, there's going to be room. If you've ever come to any of my lectures, all 47 screenings before this have been packed. By the way, I will be planning in the next couple of weeks of doing a July dance party, as we have done 51 times in the past. So I'll let you know when we find the location and where it's at. So if you know you can't come and you made a reservation, please call, because other people can call and take your place. Okay? And it's a powerful film. Now, how many times have we heard people say that we're a Christian nation? Okay, and that we were based, our whole Constitution, our founding fathers, based everything upon that, because we have this incredible relationship that I'm going to be exposing next week in a program where we have faith-based initiatives, millions, hundreds of millions of dollars given by the federal government, meaning we the taxpayer, for different religious groups to influence legislation. And whether it's Pat Robinson or any of the other. And so they get their agendas into our body politic. And all this is behind closed doors. So one of America's leading, and she calls herself America's leading Christian, is taking a look at that. Let's hear what she has to say on this.
America is a Christian nation. Just look at the Constitution. And if you're like most Americans, it's for the first time. Oh, 4,543 words. I bet you're wondering, how many are Jesus?
None.
Really? Not one? If we didn't know our founding fathers any better, that would seem almost intentional. Okay, is it just my copy? Article 6, paragraph 3, pretends to dismiss all religions as irrelevant to running a country. Rude. But as America says every national day of prayer, who cares what the Constitution says? If the Bible taught us one thing, it's that God saves all the good stuff for the amendments. Well, so does America. Let's look at the very first one. It guarantees free speech, like telling non-Christians that their faith is hilarious fiction. Now, what could be more Christian than that?
It also forbids treating Christianity as more legitimate.
That's ridiculous. The invisible people they worship aren't actually there. How embarrassing. Well, fortunately, we don't need secular scribblings to prove that America began as a Christian nation. Just look at our founding fathers. Our first Christian president was just like Jesus, only with slaves. And he, too, could not tell a lie.
Religion causes more acrimony and hatred than anything else.
Liar! Unlike wooden teeth in hell over there, our second president was a true Christian.
The United States of America is not, in any sense, founded on the Christian religion.
Okay, maybe we got off to a shockingly unchristian start. But by the time our third president came along, America was the land of the Bible.
The Bible is a dunghill.
Will I run into any founding fathers in glory?
80% of colonial Americans never stepped inside a church.
So what? The Pledge of Allegiance has always made it clear we are one nation under God.
Added in 1954.
Maybe. But our national motto has always been, in God we trust.
Not until 1956.
Security. Okay, so maybe America didn't start as a Christian nation, just like France didn't start as a Muslim one. But there is no question that America is a Christian nation now. It just happens to be full of people who are coy about showing it. Audience, call out something Jesus commanded, and I'll show you just how Christian America really is. Anyone.
Don't divorce.
Anyone else.
Don't retaliate.
I wasn't pointing to you. You and the Butterick pattern. I promise to take
yours. Give all your money to the poor.
Communist. Not you, dear. Okay, I'll show you. Think of a percentage of total wealth as square miles. The top 1% of Americans would only own this much of the country. Okay, but the top 10% would only have this proportionate share of the wealth. Now, don't jump to conclusions, because the bottom 40%, that's over 124 million people, would get stuck with New Jersey. Okay, maybe we haven't given all our money to the poor yet. And yes, it could be said that most Americans forget to stay married, do unto others, pray in
private, not judge,
or interrupt. But America is still a Christian nation, isn't it, Jesus? 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 Oh, what does he know about being an American Christian?
If parents treated their children as even-handedly as America treats its citizens, one child would get a pony for Christmas, and the rest would get cancer.
We'll have more of her thoughts on upcoming programs. Now we have this big war on drugs. Think of how many people are in prison because of it, how many homes have been wrecked. Think of how many people become incredibly rich because of our war on drugs. Look at all the different cartels. You would think that reasoned people would understand that when you take something that people want, whether it's good for them or not, away from them, prohibit it, someone's going to exploit it, create a black market for it. Here's someone who was in the war on drugs from the inside, retired now, has some thoughts on it.
You may have remembered it was a proposal, piece of legislation getting pushed around in the assembly, you know, about changing the parameters of possession of drugs, but there really is a push now nationwide, some calling for the legalization of drugs. And our guest, Peter Criss, is a former police captain. You are in favor of legalizing drugs, and some would be aghast to hear a former cop is actually saying, let's favor the legalization of drugs. Why do you think it should happen?
Okay, one thing real quick. I'm a retired police captain, so I spent 20 years, and they send me a check every month. So I just wanted to point that out. Yes, I'm one of the co-founders of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And why we came together as an organization in 2002 is because we see the failure of the policy of prohibition in our society. I was talking to somebody earlier today, and they said, well, you think these gangsters will just become honest people if we legalize drugs? And my answer to them was no. The gangsters will stay gangsters, but most of the people that are involved in this illegal trade, you really wouldn't classify as gangsters. They're more like opportunists. To give you a quick example, in 1919, there was a homicide rate in this country. We instituted alcohol prohibition in 1920. The homicide rate in this country climbed every year until it peaked in 1933 when we legalized alcohol. And by 1937, the homicide rate in America was back down to the level it was at before alcohol prohibition started. And I want to point out one other thing about 1937. That was the deepest, darkest period of the Depression in this country. So there was a lot of angry people, but they weren't killing themselves anymore because we took the product away that they were killing themselves over. Legalization of drugs is not about the drugs. It is about the gangsterism and terrorism that is supported by the illegal marketplace in this country.
So, I mean, where do you begin? Because some people just out of the gate are going, whoa, they're still trying to wrap their head around that a retired police captain wants drugs, very criminalized, now to be made legal. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, I can understand that, and it's because I think they think the issue is about the drugs. And as I said before, it isn't. It's about the crime and violence. Law enforcement was designed by a guy by the name of Robert Peel over in London, England, in the early 1800s. That's why they call them bobbies, by the way, Robert Peel. And he designed an organization of law enforcement that would protect people from other people doing them harm. When you institute a prohibition like we have with drugs in this country, what you are doing is not protecting people from other people. You are attempting to use law enforcement to protect people from themselves. Protecting you from yourself is a function of family, church, education, and the healthcare system. It never is and never should have been intended to be a law enforcement function. We are out there enforcing morality when we enforce drug laws, and that is not our job. We were not trained to do it. We are not capable of doing it. And if anything else, you see the failure of it. We've been doing this for over 40 years since Nixon kicked it off, and the drugs are more available, pure quality, and cheaper than they've ever been before on the streets of America. And we've had 40,000 deaths in Mexico in the last 5 years fighting over this drug trade. Plus, we've destroyed more lives than the drugs have by incarcerating people and hanging felony convictions on them, and denying them college educations, denying them jobs for no good reason. And one other thing I want to point out, just in case people think that if we do it hard enough, this is actually going to be doable to make drugs go away. We have the largest prison system on the planet. And I would like to point out one of the most efficient prison systems on the planet. And in that huge, efficient prison system, we do not have one drug-free prison in America. And if you cannot keep drugs out of prison, who is going to be delusional enough to think you can keep them out of a free society?
Or a high school, for that matter.
Or a high school.
Peter, this is another classic argument that's very much like Einstein's theory of insanity. You know, you can think you can do things the same way and get a different result. I think President Nixon declared war on drugs over 30 years ago. How are we doing on that war?
Well, we're losing. In fact, I speak to a lot of Rotary clubs, Kiwanis clubs, Lions clubs, and I start out my presentation by asking them a question. And the question is, do you think we can win the war on drugs? Now, let's define what winning war means. We won the Second World War. We don't fight the Germans and the Italians and the Japanese every once in a while. The war is over. We won it. It's done. Okay? That's what one war was. So if we win the war on drugs, that means we've taken the word marijuana and heroin out of the dictionary because we've defeated the drugs. They're gone. And I asked people to raise their hands, and nobody ever puts their hand up to think that's possible. So now let's change the discussion. If instead of talking about things like drug-free and winning the war on drugs, we start saying things like drugs are always going to be in our society, they're always going to be here, which group of people do you want to run the marketplace? Do you want it run by gangsters, thugs, and terrorists who have 13-year-old children selling drugs on street corners? Or do you think that maybe a licensed, regulated marketplace where we can set age limits and distribution points and control purity of drugs is a better system? Call me crazy, but I'm not a prohibitionist. I think that a better system is a regulated and controlled marketplace. And don't misunderstand me. I am not implying that if we legalize drugs, that is going to solve our alcohol problem. Just like when we legalized alcohol in 1933, that didn't solve our alcohol problem, all right? This isn't going to solve our drug problem. We have to deal with our drug problem as an educational and a healthcare issue.
So as long
my question would be then, you know, some would say, I'm sure some of the people at the Rotary Clubs, by the way, I would like to go to the next time that you speak to them because I would love to see their faces when you start your opening pitch. If you're legalizing drugs, doesn't that promote more usage?
I don't know, does it? How many people do you think in America are not using cocaine because they can't get it?
Every single person that wants to get it is going to get it.
Acquiring the drug is not what makes people decide to use it.
It's all right? about demand and supply, right, Peter? As long as there's a demand, there's going to be a supply. That's just the entrepreneurial spirit of capitalism, I suspect.
So we're going to take this down to its most minute point and say, just like a pack of cigarettes, if you choose not to smoke, you're not going to do heroin. You're not going to do cocaine.
Well, if heroin was legalized, would you go out tomorrow and do heroin?
No.
Of course not.
Of course not.
Because I know what the effects are.
Of course not. If you wanted heroin, you can get it today just about anywhere in the city.
It's interesting when you mention tobacco, because one of the comments I get from people all the time is, if we legalize drugs, what kind of a message does that send to our children? It's condoning. It's saying that drugs are really okay. Well, I like to use tobacco. And if you ask any tobacco smoker who's been smoking more than 20 years, if they ever felt condoned in this society, they'll tell you, oh, yeah, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I felt absolutely condoned. Every place I walked into, there was an ashtray. I could smoke on an aeroplane all the way from New York to Los Angeles. You ask cigarette smokers today if they feel condoned. And they'll tell you no. They feel barely tolerated by the rest of society. And let's also point out another victory. We have gotten 50% of the adult cigarette smokers to quit smoking in the last 10 years without banning one cigarette, without burning or poisoning one tobacco field, just by simply making it less easy for people to smoke, and also by talking against it and pointing out the errors of it. That's the things that work. You know, the drug czar said the other day at a press conference, and I wish if you're ever at this press conference, because you people are in the news, you would ask the question that I always want to ask. He said that this drug issue in America is fundamentally a health care and an educational problem. And nobody asked him, what other health care and educational problems do you think we should use the criminal justice system as our main approach to? Because I can't think of any.
Peter, we're going to take a quick break. Stay right there. It is a group called LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition.
That was just some of the input, and I thought very reasonable input. But here's what was not discussed, and here's the discussion we do not have in the United States. They said it was about supply and demand. Well, what motivates a person to want to try something? And they are right. If we made all drugs legal, how many people listening right now would go out and say, "Oh, good! I'm glad that methamphetamine is legal. I want to take it and burn my brain out." Some of the most powerful public service announcements I've ever seen are showing people today dying or dead, having died from smoking. We do not ask ourselves, what is the motivating factor? When does it occur? How much of it is peer pressure? How much of this occurs in homes that do not have the proper parenting, and even in homes that do, where a person is simply, it's in their nature to try things, and they're going to do it no matter what input they've had previous. How much of this is based upon feeling pain, emotional pain, loneliness? How many people drink or smoke or take drugs to in some way lessen the pain that they feel, the emptiness? I was thinking about this morning, coming down here to the studio. I was thinking about a movie I'm going to go see that's going to be opening, and how you anticipate. You build an anticipation towards an event. It could be a concert. It could be an opera. It could be a poetry reading, depending upon what you're anticipating and you're looking forward to. It could be a summer vacation. It could be getting away for the weekend. It could be going out dancing. But your mind and your energy is focused on it. And it's a building process. It builds enthusiasm, builds interest, builds desire. And then you're there. You're in the movie theater, or you're at the concert, or you're looking out a beautiful scene from your vacation. And then it goes. And then we have to start all over again to put something else in place of that to look forward to. So much of our lives are based upon looking forward to something that's going to be more remarkable than the common moment that we spend. And even people who are extraordinarily creative, most of their time is spent just doing their work, normal things. What do you think happens when a person's not on stage, not performing, not at a grand opening of a gallery? They're living a normal life. All of us are susceptible to being boring and then finding a moment where we want to distract ourselves from the tedium or boredness of our life. And so we choose something, and each person will choose based upon their conditioning, their desires, and what has motivated or stimulated them in the past. And there was a time when a lot of people went out dancing. I loved the disco scene, but that came and went, didn't like the music, and stopped going. Well, where do you think people then put that energy? If they used to spend a lot of it out dancing, they'd put it someplace. Because if you don't, then you're going to internalize it, and that energy is going to become depression or anxiety or anger. So we're a nation that has had so much stimulation, so much to do, that we have forgotten what it is just to live a normal, constructive, positive life and bring some meaning and excitement and purpose into ourselves without being passive spectators. And having people that we can go to that when we have issues, there are a support system for us. We don't have extended support systems. Some of the old families do. Some of the people who grow up in different cultures where the family is so important, and there's a way you can talk with someone who can help you, give you input. But for the average American, starting in the 1970s, we became a nuclear family nation. You were on your own. And that's never a good thing when you're trying to have someone support you and there's not a really good support system there. We never talk about that in our society, and we should, because that's where you deal with a drug problem. And what if we had places in the United States? What if we had farms or retreats where people could go to and they could have a quality of life and get counseled without being punished, without them feeling even worse about themselves? What if we had holistic psychotherapists, holistic psychologists in beautiful environments where you could go and you could help get your life back together, get the sense of purpose, get the sense of meaning, get the sense of authentic identity, so you didn't have to try to escape into any form of drug use or alcohol use. We don't have that right now. My hope is that when we become more enlightened and humanistic and caring for others, we will. But until you bring that into the equation of why people overeat, why we have an epidemic of heart disease and cancers and stress-related illnesses and prematurely aging society, the fact that people are taking a drug that is considered bad because it's been deemed illegal, but we do not consider Ritalin bad, Prozac bad, Zoloft bad, Effexor bad, the statin drugs bad, the chemotherapy bad, then we have missed the mark completely. We are confusing our efforts against positive results. Treat a person like a human being. Allow them to express themselves without you controlling the outcome. Let a person at least explain who they are and see if you can enhance or help them in that process of becoming their authentic self. If you can, then you're going to do more for them than locking them up in prison or giving them some stigmatized name or some medical defined condition. And that's all we can do now. And that's not going to change because there's just hundreds of billions of dollars a year in trying to treat the symptoms and deny the person. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day, everyone.